visions of metal detectors and keep coming back. Yeah. As somebody that has jumped the fence from way more meditation retreats than I'd like to confess about, y'all did it. It's home stretch. It's easy now. Yeah, y'all did it. I seen a little bone, like a little dog collar, but it was for a human, you know, and it said, sit, stay, heal. That's what we're doing here. So you could check that off the list, right? You made it through. Around this time in the retreat, usually I'm, depending on the retreat, either I'm wishing it were longer or I'm wishing it was just a little bit shorter. Some way it's just not right. But if you jumped in my car and drove to Oakland with me, in my house, a very beautiful place. I've been there a long time. And me and my partner, we painted the door. And it's beautiful. It's red with gold lotus leaves and keys hanging off. And I mean, it's one of the most beautiful doors I've ever seen. And we call it the temple door. But it's on the inside. Because our house is like the refuge. And the temple is the world. You know? So when I walk out my door, it's like, okay, let's get down. You know? Full contact. Yeah. So this is a beautiful refuge that we've been in. And now it's time to get down. You know? Yeah. Conditions here are so conducive to receptivity, safety, allowing us to touch our vulnerability, you know? Very, very beautiful. And safe space. Sometimes the thought of the world can just do something to my nervous system. Because I know how fast things are moving out there, you know? It's a great place to practice. They say that this realm that we're in has just the right amount of balance of enough suffering to want to wake up, but not too much suffering to where you're just debilitated by it. So think about, you know, what have we been practicing here? Slowing down, getting kind of intimate with ourselves in the moment. I'm of the belief that we're always practicing something, you know? For a long time I practiced you know, nihilism and really as fast as I can, as hard as I can, as, you know, as much as I can, you know. It was a different kind of concept of full contact, you know. I didn't think I was long for this world. I thought it was going to be a short ride, so let's make it really fun. That led me to Narcotics Anonymous. But the world is a great place to practice, I think. We get to see our relationship, you know, how we're meeting experience, right? And when we see that, a lot more relationally out there in the world, right? There's a lot of others there. Here, there's a few dozen people. Not too much to handle. There's my family, there's my friends, my sangha, there's a lot of folks. And then we get to see our relationship to the material world, to these bodies and aging. It's quite amazing how many places there are to practice. And so we've been sitting in this field, reflecting on the Brahma-viharas and these Four Noble Truths. Quite wholesome qualities. Yeah. When I think about the path and these two reflections that we've been trying to interweave throughout the week, it really comes down to bringing it home to myself. I know a lot of us have just thought we could, through tyranny, that we could hate ourselves into becoming better people, you know? It's just such a bad strategy, you know? And if I look back, that's what my dad did, and that's what his dad did, and slow learners. So, this compassionate way of being with ourselves. It's such a gift. When we bring that same kind of tyranny to the practice, it's like, no, this is a refuge from that. We don't have to be good at this. You get to suck at this. There's no like performance evaluation, you know? It's such a conditional, habituated way of being that we think the only way we're going to get it is with the stick, you know? We're training with, some people call, I've heard it called an appropriate response to this life, to this world, to all of these conditions. What is an appropriate response? Each moment being born, it feels like we have a chance to care for this kind of newborn baby in every moment. Like, what is this one like? This one is screaming her head off, or this one is very calm, or this one is quite beautiful, or this one's boring, you know? Whatever it is, you know? We get a chance to tend to this newborn moment. Every moment, literally, pregnant with liberation. Every moment, come check me out. Check it out. The moment's full. And I love retreat, you know, because we get a chance to try to unplug. And that can be so skillful. But we also need to know how to engage. And so that'll be the practice coming up now, right? As we go back into the world. How do we engage and still not leave ourselves, right? This balance, this balancing act. It's quite something. Try to see how much of my attention is internal and how much needs to come out to receive the world? How leaned out of my experience do I have to be to get you? You know, is it 80-20? Is it 80-20? Where is it? And it, our life calls for different amount of balance points, right? Sometimes it's calling for more of us. Sometimes we can sit back and just receive. Somebody asked me recently, they said, you know, why do you think you got into this practice in particular? I think I was trying to find a way to understand these changing conditions, because I just really was convinced that the conditions in and of themselves were causing me suffering. And I was quite taken back to understand that I was a large part of that cause. But it was great news, because I knew I couldn't do anything about the conditions in which I was born into. But I did have this second arrow that I didn't have to plunge. And that was more power than I had ever been given. There was a chance at freedom, no matter what was happening. This idea that I was bringing as much to experience as experience was bringing to me. It was really cool. And that through skillfully responding, this appropriate response, my life could get a lot better. Part of what we've been sitting with is when we talk about this intimacy with ourselves, is intimacy with our joy, intimacy with our pain? Nobody had ever instructed me on how to do that. I just figured everybody was doing all they could to push pain away by any means necessary. So this practice is calling on a very different way of being. And we see that pleasure is arising, discomfort, thoughts. What a play. I sometimes see experience or the play of appearance as like a dance that I'm in with the moment. And I'm never quite sure who's leading, you know? I'm not sure if it's reality or if I'm just dreaming myself into existence, like moment by moment, dancing with what is. And meanwhile, the backdrops change, right? It's like this play. The backdrops change, and yet we remain like what we've been practicing is becoming at home here. These qualities are literally emanating from us when we practice them. I remember walking through the gates. I worked at San Quentin for a long time, teaching meditation, and I would feel pretty safe amongst scary conditions. And I was always kind of like doing these Brahma Viharas. It was like I was kind of slipping the cat some contraband, you know, under my breath, you know. It was always this kind of loving kind of feelings, you know. So we've been talking a lot about these Brahma Viharas, the Four Noble Truths, all week, and Joanna talked about the Eightfold Path last night. And they both of them shared about how much they disliked the Brahma Viharas in the beginning. And my competitive mind says, I hated them. I really did. I would literally be sending the teacher arrows of hate. I was like, there's no way you could believe this. There's no way you came from any neighborhood like mine. There's no way. Anything I could do, you know? And, you know how it is. Like, the things you hate the most are my favorite ones now. You know, it was the Brahma Viharas and the forgiveness practice were the ones that I disliked so intensely. Now I can't imagine my life without them. Funny. So just stay tuned to anything that you have a big reaction around. It's probably an old friend in disguise, you know? So we're practicing these really wholesome qualities, right? And we've been talking about the Four Noble Truths. And the Four Noble Truths, they're pretty heavy. You know, there's a gravity or a weight to them when I consider suffering and the cause and the end. And I always felt rather duped on that Fourth Noble Truth, because it leads to a whole nother list, like some kind of pyramid scheme. I was just about to be done. You gonna give me 8 more things to do now? Like an Amway situation, you know? But where it delivers us, it's literally like the robes that we get to walk out of here in. You know, like we can't take the place with us. But they give us a way to walk through the world that's so beautiful that we don't have to leave, that we get to stay. I love that. It gives us a way to walk through the world. Because I don't know how to live the noble truths, you know? But the Eightfold Path is super clear. That if I keep these things close to me, they're a kind of safety, like the precepts in a way. I remember Jack tells this beautiful story of when he was a young man in India, you know, young practitioner, and he sits, you know, he's at the guru's feet, and he had just come back from a long trip, and he sits down, room full of students. He goes, "Where have you been?" He goes, "I was right here." He goes, "You know, mountains came, cities came, countrysides, trains, planes, everything. But I've always been right here." Teacher gave him a low bow, you know? And that's how it is, right? We've been practicing right here. Right here. You know, there's some sweat equity in those cushions. You know what I'm saying? There's some tears. The room might be a little better off because of our efforts, but we've been practicing right here. We've been learning to stay as things arise, as things pass away from right here. This is always the vantage point. Every moment, the practice calling us home, you know? Gill spoke about clinging to form. And we have to let this form go for now, you know? If you go home and ring a bell, I don't think anybody's going to get you dinner. I don't know what kind of situation you're in. My house, it don't work. Some of you might really be ready to let this form go. You know what I'm saying? Like, cool. But there's a certain kind of beauty and simplicity in this container. I've been really digging it. I was sharing with a practitioner this idea of coming home and what does it mean to me, you know? It's almost like an amnesia. You know, when I walk into a practice and I sit down and I feel that, you know, that kind of feeling when you come back from a week of work, you know, and you walk into your house and you know that there's nobody you have to be right now. You just get to be. You can't do that moment wrong. It's just, that relief. And then I find myself like transported, you know, in the middle of the street, you know, in the middle of a thought. And I'm far from my house, you know. I'm like, how did that happen? And then I arrive again back at my door. This practice of coming home, I think hundreds of times in one session. Practicing this coming home. And we could do it anywhere. We're building that confidence that no matter where we are, we're one breath away or one moment away from landing back in our direct experience. Rilke writes, "The hour is striking so close above me, so clear and sharp that all my senses ring with it. I feel it now. There's a power in me to grasp and give shape to my world. I know that nothing has ever been real without my beholding it. All becoming has needed me. My looking ripens things as they come toward me, to meet and be met." The world is coming toward us to meet and be met. Our experience. The content of the moment and how we meet it. We get to do that with kindness if we choose, or otherwise. I know that as I started really getting into the Brahmaviharas, it seemed like the whole world was changing before my eyes. I'd done a lot of different kind of work, you know, volunteer work and stuff, before I really got involved in the practice. I had no idea really how transformative it would be that if I saw myself through kind eyes, that the world would change. Or if I looked through kind eyes, how much the world would change. It sounds rather pedestrian as I say it. But it really does feel like we dream the world into existence. At least a good part of it. No matter how it feels right now, guaranteed there's a bit more clarity than when you arrived. So this self-intimacy, it doesn't have to end here when you leave tomorrow. We get to start over every day, every moment, another opportunity. And so I said we're building this trust, or this confidence in the practice, in ourselves, in our direct experience, and using the body as a refuge, all these different ways that we've been training. This T.S. Eliot poem, "We shall not cease from exploration. In the end of all our exploring will be to arrive where we started and know the place for the first time." Sometimes it takes going away to really come home. You know, sometimes the world has a way of dulling our vision. Hildegard von Bingen writes, "An interpreted world is not a home." So if we're perceiving a story, we're not perceiving the universe. So this is why the practice can help us so much, as we can continue to challenge these fixed views we have. See the suffering that comes from believing our current story about reality. When we really challenge our fixed views and our beliefs, there's an aliveness and a fullness that was unbeknownst to us within this living presence, you know. So we go home to our jobs or our homes or our pets or our pillows, our neighborhoods. And they use this saying a lot on retreats, and they say, when you go home, you know, don't be a Buddhist, be a Buddha, you know? Otherwise, you just walk around bothering people. It's true. And I am speaking from direct experience. Here's a confession. When I first got turned on to the practice, they started calling me Vinny Swagger because I was always preaching the gospel, you know? Oh, man. You know, people might ask you, how was it last week? Well, they don't really care. They want to know you're okay, but they don't, you know what I mean? Listen, there was this moment. I was really with the breath, you know? And they're just going to think you were tripping or something, you know? There's one rule, don't make it weird, you know? Most of these are, you had to be there moments, you know? I love the way Krishnamurti writes about identity. He says, does not the very act of identification put an end to inquiry, to discovery? The happiness that truth brings cannot be there if there's no experimentation in self-discovery. Identification puts an end to discovery. It's another form of laziness. Identification is vicarious experience and hence utterly false. So once we become something that's fixed, like a good meditator or something, Buddhist, there's a certain kind of end to the experimentation of it, you know? I think that's why I really like so much teaching here, because Gil gives a lot of permission to experiment, to try things. You know, usually I'm so kind of like locked into wanting to be a good teacher that wasn't really so present this time. She was like, oh, you're just going to practice being the teacher. They get to practice being the yogis. They're going to practice being the cooks. Like, this is just role-playing. It's fine. Don't take it too seriously, dude. It's not like you're an actual teacher. Right? He seemed to say. We go back to a world of people in our families, many of us, and our friends. And that it's a great act of generosity to come and practice. Yeah. I think we come back with some fresh eyes. To see this place brand new. And sometimes it could be a house of cards, you know? Yeah. When I go visit my family on the East Coast, sometimes it's like I'm an alien, you know? I've been a visitor for 25 years, you know? So it's nothing new to me, but it's really like, so where have you been? What have you been doing? So you're teaching people how to relax. You know, I ran into an old friend yesterday in Santa Cruz. It was my birthday yesterday, so my sweetie went out to bought me some dinner, and I ran into a guy that I used to work construction with, and I told him what I'm doing. He goes, oh, this is definitely your calling. I wasn't much of a construction worker, you know. So how do we keep dipping into this well that we've been drinking out of every day? How do we keep the Four Noble Truths, the Eightfold Path, these Brahma Viharas, all this practice, you know? How do we keep it close to us? The same way we've been doing here. Whatever you practice, we develop. You know, the mind is like tofu. Whatever it rests on, it becomes. You know? Trying to get serious, y'all. Help me here, help me. The busyness, you know, William James, he talks about it. He says, we're pushing up against this ceaseless frenzy of always thinking we should be doing something else. Yeah, many of us lead really busy lives. And so when we sit down, the first thought that comes to us is, man, you got other things to do, you know? So I find it really helpful to just have a time of day where it's not an option. When I feel overwhelmed, I recall, you know, Joseph Goldstein, a great teacher, and he said, look, there's only ever six things that could be happening, you know, and he's talking about the senses, you know. Seeing, smelling, hearing, tasting, touching, and things coming up in the mind. I like that because when I get overwhelmed, I just try to break it down to what is it exactly that's happening. And I have a very convincing inner voice that goes along with experience. And I notice if I can see that, then I can, it's almost, upon seeing it, it's almost dismissed. And then I could tend to what's arising, whether it's contractions in the chest or whether it's a burning in the belly. You know, the story about what's going on is usually way more powerful to me than my actual experience. Gil was talking two nights ago about the space in between thoughts, how much space there is even in this room, you know. We're so oriented to the things in the space and not the space. One of my teachers was telling me, they said, look, if you took all the space out of matter, this whole world would fit into like a tablespoon. It just boggles the mind because, you know, I'm just the concrete and the trees and the water, all of that, if you took the space out of it, would fit into a tablespoon. So we tune our vision to the space between as well as what's arising. That was a huge shift in practice for me. I hope it's helpful. I know that I swing, and many of us, as I talk to people in the interviews and stuff, many of us swing between these, you know, tremendous caring and then otherwise, or, you know, optimism and pessimism, you know? And it's like, well, where are we supposed to find our balance, you know? And I got this friend, he's a very sweet guy. He's got two kids. Son's about 15, daughter I think is about 10. And he's driving them to school. And the daughter's talking to him about this word optimism. And obviously pessimism comes up. And so he's like, well, you know, he's explaining it to her. He says, you know, if you got this glass half full, and So she's getting it. She's like, all right, that makes sense. And the son was kind of looking out the window, and, you know, countryside. And he says, what are you guys talking about? And he goes, well, listen. This is perfect, he says to the daughter. We can see what his view is. Okay, so if I gave you a cup of juice that was filled to the halfway point, what would you say? Kid turns around. Thank you. Joseph wisely says, it doesn't matter what you're not clinging to. Beautiful, difficult, subtle, sublime. Any flavor of experience. All are welcome to pass through. We can still enjoy it. I consider myself somebody that luxuriates in experience. I savor, I relish. And we try to let go when it brings suffering. We see it. We know when we're suffering. Nobody's got to teach us that. So practice in the world is much more engaged. A lot more decisions to make, you know? There's a beautiful story of Milarepa, a Tibetan yogi. And, you know, he lived a pretty wild life in the shadows earlier on. And then he became this one of the greatest yogis ever. And toward the end of his life, he brought, you know, his star student. And the student was, you know, lockstep with him. He said, all right, you want the real. He's at the end of his life. He's ready to pass it on, you know. He goes, all right, man. Up there. So they start hiking this mountain, you know. They do puja, ritual, very formal transmission. And then the moment of truth arrives. Which, on a side note, I believe is every moment. But what he does is he asks him, he says, are you ready? Student, right there. And he turns around and he lifts up his robes. He shows them all the calluses on his ass. He goes, that's the secret teaching. Just sit. I love that story. What an image. The calloused ass of my teacher. The Eightfold Path, I'll just say that. You know, I started going into it in this talk, and I was just like, man, there's no way. It's a wheel. So every spoke has the same amount of importance. So how do you say, okay, I'm going to talk about right understanding, but not right view. I'm going to talk about, you know, it's a very interesting way to live. There is a freedom beyond this prison of preferences that is applicable to all conditions. So wherever you find yourself, know that the practice is there with you, waiting. Calling us home, really. I'll end with these words of Wu Men. He wrote them about 800 years ago. 10,000 flowers in spring, the moon in autumn, a cool breeze in summer, snow in winter. If your mind isn't clouded by unnecessary things, this is the best season of your life. Thank you for your time and attention.